Coming up next, it's hour number two of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. This hour, we're going to talk about a rather interesting project and person who has helped promulgate this project here in Santa Cruz, Gary Winnick, who we had on last year.
About a year ago, Alan.
Yeah, that's it. Well, welcome, Gary, back to the show. Gary's a graphic illustrator, artist, and game designer, among other things. And he, at the time where we left Gary, he was going to try to do a Kickstarter project to create a comic of one of his ideas. What happened there, Gary?
Well, what happened was...
Bad dreams, right?
I went ahead and decided to see if I could crowdfund it on Kickstarter.
Uh-huh.
Because I had learned a little bit about crowdfunding, and a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. So
yeah.
I determined that I would go ahead and try to raise $15,000 at the time.
Yeah, a modest amount to do an illustrated
comic. To just
print
the books. Then I'd have a garage full of books, and I'd be trying to sell you one right now. But effectively what happened is I did not raise the $15K. And the way Kickstarter works, it's an all-or-nothing platform. So I raised about $5,000. And it did not go within the 30 days, I met a lot of people.
There's it. So it didn't work out with the money, but it was still worth doing.
Because it was seen by a publisher, Red 5, who is a independent publisher located in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
They publish probably about a dozen to 20 books, depending on, and their most famous one is a thing called Atomic Robo. Mm. And they picked up the book.
Mm.
So it's come out... is a five-issue limited series, is what they call floppies. That's what they refer to the single issues of comics in the industry.
Yeah, Gary gave me one right here.
Yeah, and then
playing it up for the first time.
What will happen is, because going straight to trade paperback is sort of like going straight to video.
Wow.
So we've done this book. It's gotten good critical reviews. We've sold out of the first several issues. And we will be releasing the trade paperback. It'll be in Barnes & Noble and regular booksellers, also at your comic book stores, Atlantis Fantasy World, the most local one here, come, I believe, February.
Great. Wow.
So that's the story of that.
So we're jumping into the middle. So you're already sold out of the first three issues.
I believe so.
And here we are lucky enough to have issues 4, 5, and 6 in our hands.
Well, you'll get 1 and 2 in your hands because you know people.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Well, we must have the
artist.
Great, Gary. Well, congratulations on this.
Thank you.
Great. So the Kickstarter was successful in that you met the right people to publish the book. The publisher was paying attention.
And actually, it was a better deal for me than it would have been if I'd raised the money because, as I said, I would have ended up with a garage full of books responsible for distributing myself. They've done all the public relations. They have the regular distribution network. They print it. They do everything.
Beautiful.
I just sit back and hopefully collect a check.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. Which hasn't happened yet, but it's really
it will, but it hasn't happened yet. The way
artist.
These things work is it takes a little, there's a little bit of a cycle involved, you know, in doing that. But
yes. What's interesting is that it did happen and we got one in our hands here.
It's yes.
Thank you. You're now involved with another Kickstarter campaign. And this time...
It's a different story.
Yes. This is an amazing story, folks. You'll see.
So, you know, having had some experience with Kickstarter and crowdfunding, I had been trying to actually get something off the ground with my good friend Ron Gilbert. He and I worked at Lucasfilm together, mm-hmm. where we'd created the first point-and-click, or one of the first point-and-click verb-driven
games
called Maniac Mansion in 1987.
Now, can you take us back there for a second?
That was way early days of computer games.
For the uninitiated.
Commodore C64, yes.
Most people know Lucas in terms of movies, but... He also had a division making games.
Well,
right? That's for
Lucasfilm itself was made up of a number of divisions besides the film division. There was
Where the money was. They were making the bucks.
Yeah.
They were paying for everything else.
Industrial Light and Magic was a special
effects
house.
Uh-huh.
We had a thing called the Droid Works, which they had the computer division, and the computer division consisted of Droid Works, Pixar, and us, which was at that time Lucasfilm Games.
Lucasfilm Games. That was the mid-80s.
That is correct.
Okay. So we're talking pre-Windows machines. We're talking...
Our original deal was with Atari.
Uh-huh.
They gave us $1 million to fund two, I'm going to use the word test case games, and we went ahead and actually made those games, and then we ended up getting a number of other funding things in place. George used to say three things, which was stay small, be the best, and don't lose any money, which we sort of changed to use other people's money.
George Lucas's money.
Well, not George. George Lucas was actually...
other people's money?
Very adept at... Yeah. Or I'm going to say people who worked for George Lucas were adept at having us do business deals with other companies that in turn paid for most of what we were doing.
Oh.
Right. You were the expense items on the gigs.
We're the creatives.
But we actually did make money. So we did a number of adventure games with the SCUMM system that Ron built, which stands for Script Creation Utility for Maniac Mansion.
Now this created a sort of a gaming environment that was...
It was a graphic adventure gaming environment. We did Maniac Mansion. We did Day of the Tentacle. We did Monkey Island. Ron did Monkey Island 1 and 2, which were actually they're considered some of the best adventure games ever made. They're on all the top 10 lists.
Remember, folks, this was the early days of microcomputing. This was mid-80s, right? And so the machines were fairly new to they could do this sort of thing. Before this, machines couldn't do this.
And we stuck pretty much with home computer systems. So we went from Atari to C64 to IBM. And some console stuff, early console stuff like Nintendo. Yeah.
Okay, so in this environment where Lucas could see that gaming was perhaps going to be an up-and-coming world, you and Ron got to know each other. This is your current companion. This new amazing story that you're about to find. But after the break, we're going to go to a few commercials first.
All right,
we're going to get back to Gary Winnick and
Ron
Halbert and their days in Lucasfilm that led to what you were about to hear.
All right, stay tuned for more here on the Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back.
Hey, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're with Gary Winnick in the studios, who's telling us the story of his latest game. Actually, it's a computer game that has a mid-80s vintage appeal to it. You're trying to create something that takes you back. Is that it, Gary?
Yeah, you partnered up with Ron.
That was the intent because one of the things that Ron and I both agree on, first of all, was the first game we ever made, period. The fact that we made it together was actually a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And we really wanted to get that same experience back, and we wanted to sort of have that ourselves as well as give that to potentially players.
And what is so great about that experience?
Take us to the experience for the radio audience. What's it like to play a point-and-click game from the mid-80s?
I will say what it's like to make a point-and-click game is a hell of a lot of fun, at least if you're making it with Ron Gilbert.
Okay,
here you go. Anything you do with Ron Gilbert is going to be fun.
So this was a lot of fun to make back in those days. You guys at Lucasfilm enjoyed making these games?
At the time, we like to say that because the parent company was doing so well, and we were really kind of just sort of a side note, we really had no adult supervision.
I see.
We were allowed to kind of do whatever we wanted to do as long as it wasn't Star Wars. The reason it wasn't Star Wars, and when we went there, we thought we were going to make Star Wars games, is because those things had been licensed out to other companies for millions of dollars. And so therefore the rights were not currently
at Lucas. You were there.
So we had to come up with our own stuff. In retrospect, if it wasn't for that, there wouldn't be a Maniac Mansion or a Monkey Island or a Grim Fandango or a Day of the Tentacle or any of those games which are considered, classics today.
There you go. Mm. The luck of the draw.
So did you make up the game style back then too? I guess the whole thing was new, right?
The answer is yes, to a degree. In other words, we were too stupid to know how hard it was to do things, so we just figured we'd do them and we'd figure it out while we went. And while we figured it out, we had to change some of the things that we did, but for the most part, things actually ended up working out. Mm-hmm. Because there were, at that time, the graphics, which you see now in this project I'll be talking about, were state of the art.
Very pixel-aided compared to today's stuff.
Yeah, you have 8-bit graphics at the time? I mean, that was probably brand new, right?
Yeah, at the time. Like I say, it was state of the art at the time.
Yeah, but you had sound, and you could click and make little figures go places.
We
had scrolling screens, we had multiple characters, we had multiple endings. Actually, SCUMM was a scripting language, so they could actually wire things up very quickly. So it was a game that had a lot of nuance and style to it.
Could the characters talk?
The answer is it was all text.
They could text talk then.
They could text talk. Eventually, they've become talkies. And in fact, the game we're doing right now will most likely be a talkie. You'll be able to turn the sound on or off if you want that, true nostalgic experience.
Still be texting. The interface is still a text-based interface.
The interface is a point-and-click interface. The characters talk in text, and it shows up at the top of the screen, like in word balloons, effectively.
Cool.
So you have some multiple choices when you talk to them, but you don't type anything. It's all point-and-click.
So how did it come that you and Ron decided to create a new game on this style after all these years?
Well,
why not use the modern technologies?
We had been looking for something to do. We had actually worked on a couple of different projects. We were trying to get traction with something new because Ron and I generally are pretty busy. And it just so happened that we both became free at the same time, which was unusual. Mm. And we said, hey, we should do something together. And so I kind of worked on a couple of different concepts that we didn't really get any traction with. We got interest, but not what I'm going to call traction. Mm. Basically, it's everybody's job in Hollywood or in the venture community to sort of keep telling you how interested they are and not write a check. I said, how do you know if they like it? They write a check. So if they don't write a check, they really don't like it no matter what they say.
Okay, so traction means checks.
I think traction means finance, money. Yeah, that's what it comes to.
Yeah.
And so having had the experience with Kickstarter before, Ron sort of looked at me and said, well, why don't we do a Kickstarter?
Yeah.
And you said,
I tried that, and I tried to get 15,000, and I only got five.
I did say, for this, I think that's a good idea.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay, because you did make the connections through Kickstarter.
Yes, I'll just say this quickly. We launched on November 18th, we were asking for $375,000 to build this over an 18-month period because it's obviously a lot more complicated.
$375,000. That's a lot more than 15.
That is correct, but it's a lot harder to make a video game than a comic book from my perspective.
Yeah. Yes, totally.
I can do everything and draw a comic book. I can draw a page a day or whatever I can do.
But $375 is about right for a computer game these days.
Given the nature of what we want to build, and it's fairly complicated. And the thing that's complicated is not the graphics. The graphics are complicated to a degree, but the thing that's complicated is the actual building the entire game and the logic and everything else associated with it.
Yeah, it's the story. It's the cinematic part
of it. So we just determined that we could do this for around $375. We launched it on November
8th. $75,000, yeah.
Yeah, excuse me. Yes. Yeah. We launched it on November 18th. Mm-hmm. And in the first 5 days, we exceeded the $375,000.
5 days?
First 5 days.
Wow. Testimonial.
And then...
interesting.
Currently... Yeah. We have till the 18th of December, which is, I think, about another 8 days. And we're sitting here at $492,000 last time.
So you're looking for $375,000 and you got $492,000.
Set a new record today.
In less than a month total. And
Just another $8,000, you'll be over $500,000.
I'm predicting that by tomorrow.
You'll be $500,000.
All right, KSU audience.
Well, not bad for a Santa Cruz artist.
A local artist do good here. There's a bunch of the Kickstarter campaign.
Well, yes, like I have to hear, how did this happen? Is this a miracle or was it predictable?
I mean, I think to a certain degree it was more predictable than what I did before.
How so?
Well, first of all, Ron has a great amount of
following. Yeah.
He's got 60,000 followers on Twitter.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that helped.
Those are real people.
Yep. We have sort of stayed on top of Facebook. We've stayed on top of social networking. And once we started doing it, it was news in the computer gaming industry. So the computer gaming industry news picked it up.
Their ears picked up when they saw that you met your quota.
And then a bunch of other sort of more mainstream press like TechCrunch and Wired and stuff like that are picking it up.
That's right. You said you're going to be interviewed by Wired tomorrow.
Correct. Yeah. So definitely it's one of those things that kind of feeds itself.
Interesting.
And on top of that, it's a fabulous product.
On top of that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, most people who see the trailer do get it and like it.
Yeah.
So everybody out there, take a look at it, get it and like it. Or like it and get it or something.
Maybe we can play the trailer on the air. It really sucks you in a good way. Yeah. I liked it. Okay. We don't have to do it right now. Well, I'm just saying.
Okay. Now, you wrote this with Ron and just decided to do the Kickstarter and put it up. And less than a week, you already met your goal of $375,000.
Our basic goal, which, as I said, the way Kickstarter works is if you don't make your ask, you don't get any of the money.
Right.
So if we had made $374,000 and that's all we made, we wouldn't have got any of the money.
At that point,
I would have thrown in $1,000.
Yeah, right.
Good.
I was wondering why you would choose Kickstarter over, say, Indiegogo.
Okay, there's a number of differences. First of all, Kickstarter is kind of, you know, it's sort of, I'm going to say, the eBay of crowdfunding. You know, it's the one that everybody knows. So it definitely has a much higher profile than Indiegogo. Even though Indiegogo is cool, I don't have a lot of familiarity directly with Indiegogo, where I had the experience with Kickstarter, and a number of people we'd worked with had also worked with Kickstarter and raised money through that. So definitely felt like it was the right fit for this.
Uh-huh. There's certainly a lot of other companies in crowdsourcing now that kind of specialize in the arts. Have you considered any of those?
Once again, Kickstarter sort of specializes in creative projects.
Okay, so they already had it.
And in fact, if you read about Kickstarter, they're kind of a really interesting company started kind of by bohemian artist types in New York.
Yeah. Sure.
So they are actually very much in, I'm going to use the word, the, I hate to say words like this because marketing people use them, but in the wheelhouse of what we were looking for. You know?
So, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you attribute your success to Ron's Twitter list and the trailer, or was there some other magic in the mix?
I think that it's a combination of things, but those are kind of the main things, is that Ron's visibility in the gaming industry is one of those things. I think the vision of what we want to create is very nostalgic and speaks to a lot of people who grew up on this stuff. And, you know, we've seen that certainly in all the comments and all the feedback we've been getting from our backers. I think that we did a really cool trailer. Even though it's not 8-bit music, we have really cool music that we're using. It has kind of a, I'm going to use the way Maniac Mansion was a parody of B-horror movies. We're doing more of a, we're doing kind of a parody of Twin Peaks and True Detective and The X-Files with a little bit of Stephen King thrown in. So we're going to do to those genres what we did to the horror genre with Maniac Mansion.
Oh, great.
So you'll be using things like balloon animals on corpses.
Spoof mysteries.
I mean, the characters are sort of too washed up
to text
each other. We have a clown who's named Ransom, who has been cursed so he can never take his makeup off.
Oh, my. Do you know that there is a clown in Santa Cruz named Ransom?
I did not know that.
No, I mean, he's a clown as a character.
Oh, okay.
He's a person.
Okay, well, this is a real circus clown.
Yeah. Right.
And then we also have a woman, Dolores, who is at the reading of her family's will. And then we have another guy, Franklin, who's a dead guy who wakes up in a hotel and he's dead. And he's trying to figure out what happened to him.
Oh, dear.
And all of these stories will come together and sort of explain the whole story of Thimbleweed Park, which is a place which is kind of a crummy town that's all run down.
Thimbleweed Park. Huh?
Thimbleweed.
Thimbleweed, is this, where does this exist?
Somewhere in the United States and the Twilight Zone, yes.
Yeah. Okay, with Thimbleweed Park. Well, good. Very interesting, Gary. We'll talk more about this after the break. We're talking with Gary Winnick and his new project, Thimbleweed Park, interactive game from the 80s genre today.
It's on Kickstarter. How do you find it on Kickstarter?
Thimbleweed Park, T-H-I-M-B-L-E-W-E-E-D. If you type that in, you'll find it.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Gary Winnick, who is doing a new project. How do you call this, Gary? Retro?
It's really referred to just kind of as an old school video game.
Old school video game. That's from the mid 80s type of video game. Point and click. You run into flat characters that speak to you. Any AI in this?
The answer is not exactly. I wouldn't use AI. It's just all branching. It's all canned.
Your interactive storytelling, basically,
right.
Taking the idea that you can go many different directions.
Sure, and you have people on a track. You know that you just don't want them to think they're on a track, mm-hmm. but they're on a track.
Yes, they're going to their branch of the tree.
Yeah. So
is it an adventure game where you have to like pick up a key and open a door?
Exactly. Except it's more like pick up a rubber chicken with a pulley in it and slide down the rope, that kind of thing.
Think about that.
Slide down the rope.
I see.
Silly.
That's one of the sort of trademarks of the games that we did, is they have sort of this wacky sense of humor. Monkey Island is very famous for that, actually. And that rubber chicken with a pulley in it is a real puzzle for Monkey Island.
So the two of you get together and these ideas just flow, huh?
Pretty much. I mean, the way we work is that we both design the story together. We brainstorm that together. We work out all of the puzzles together. He does all the programming and I do all the art.
Hey,
and that's kind of how it works.
Good team.
Made in heaven.
and there's not a lot of us on it, actually. You were asking about that. We're going to bring on another artist and another programmer probably in about 6 months after we've designed the actual project. But most of the money is it's going to take, you know, close to 2 years, well, 18 months to create this. And then there are some additional things. Kickstarter and Amazon take 10% right off the top.
But then they give the rest to you in cash, though, right?
Effectively, yes.
Yeah.
It's Amazon payments, and then it's transferred into a bank account. So, yeah, it's
cash.
Isn't
that amazing that you can give them $50,000, but then you'll get $450,000?
Well, hopefully we'll get more than that because we have another 8 days to go.
Yeah.
And typically the Kickstarter curve is it goes up real high in the beginning, then it kind of roller coasters down, then it goes up high at the end. That's sort of the metrics of it, at least typically. I'm not going to predict what we're going to get, but the other thing is we have stretch goals. And what stretch goals are is if we make $525,000, mm-hmm. we're going to do real voice recording with actors. If we get $625,000, we're going to do iOS and Android version.
Wow.
So those things cost money on top of what we're doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you put those stretch goals in the current one so that people will continue to add to it because they can see that there are more things that
they can see that they can see what they'll get if they continue to pony up dough.
Nice. Now, what do you ascribe this success to? Is to the 60,000 followers for starters, getting it going. Is there a renewal of 80s nostalgia today?
I think so. As I said before, awful lot of these people grew up playing the games that we created.
Really? So it is a generation that grew up with these games that are probably
It is kind of, scary when people who come up to me and Ron, who look like, way grown up adults, going, I played this when I was a little kid and I loved it. And I'm like, okay, I don't know how old I feel right now, but I feel old.
Yeah, you hang around long enough, there's just no escape.
Yeah. Now, this wackiness in the story, was this something that you and Ron first explored at Lucasfilm?
Correct. For us, I'm going to say this, it's easier to write comedy than it is to write something serious, especially given the nature of what you're asking a player to do in an adventure game. You're asking a player to basically run around and pick up everything that they can find in the entire game and stick it in their pants and carry it around with them and then combine it in silly ways. So it kind of lends itself more to comedy than, another medium.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying, because a lot of people were doing really serious things with that back then.
I think there's the same way in movies you have, I'm going to say drama and comedy. We tend to just kind of go down that comedy road because that works for us. And it's easier for us to poke fun at stuff than it is to try to make it serious. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At least that worked for us.
Mm. Absolutely. So who's your audience?
Well, people your age?
People younger than me. People my age, too. I don't want to say how old I am, but...
well, younger, the ones that were 11 when you wrote it.
Yeah, what about your kids?
You tested out on your kids?
My kids like those stupid shooter games. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a big shooter fan. I have played a few of them, but generally I like things that make you think a little bit more. And the puzzle solving thing, it's one of those things where you'll be playing a game and you'll get stuck and you'll be wandering through the supermarket later and you'll see, salt next to snail killer and you'll go, oh, they want me to put the salt on the snails, or whatever. And it's that aha moment when they sort of realize and make the connection of what we're trying to get them to do.
Oh, interesting. Uh-huh. So you give them little puzzles to solve by, like, if they combine things, something will happen that will open something.
Pretty much, yeah. Everything really kind of, on a basic level, boils down to a lock and a key.
Yeah.
Whether it's feeding tentacle chow to a tentacle, so they'll let you go by, or whether or not it's like playing high-pitched music to break a chandelier that has a key in it so it'll fall to the ground. Those are all puzzles we've done. Mm-hmm. And effectively, they're all kind of lock and key kind of things. They just have a lot of window dressing on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. That's very common in those days to do that. I think they were in the what they call the MUDs before that, before they even had graphics. Remember those? The first games were multi-user dungeons.
I do remember that stuff. We were sort of, we sort of immersed ourselves in this kind of thing because we were sort of trying to create, at the time it was sort of a new genre, but Sierra Online had just come out with King's Quest and Space Quest. So those things were actually games that you played, and they actually had animated graphics on the screen, and you walked around and you interacted with the environment and picked up things. So they're sort of, in my mind, at the very primitive form that they're at, sort of the missing link between games and interactive movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And chances are we will get to interactive movies. That's been a buzzword for a long time in Hollywood, and George and Steven Spielberg have sort of, investigated different things. And effectively, graphic adventures are very story and character driven, and they are kind of the stepping stone to interactive film. Mm-hmm. Now, at the level of graphics I'm doing right now, I don't really consider, and that's not high art, but the thing that's interesting about this level of graphics is it's very charming and innocent, And it's tantamount to playing with colorful animated icons where you can look at it and immediately understand what's going on. Your imagination fills in the world, kind of like Minecraft. It's kind of like being, you know, the Scotty Dog in Monopoly, or the Cannon in Monopoly, where you've create and imagine the world on your own, which I think is actually sort of a very interesting exercise.
Right. They say that that's why reading is better for you than watching movies, because you use
or
you
watching
use your
TV.
Mind.
Yeah.
Or watch your mind. They say that about radio too. It's theater of the mind.
So as far as games go, it is something where I believe engages the player to use their puzzle solving skills, their imagination and visualization in order to see something.
Yeah, that's cool. Then you can use that increased intelligence from doing that to solve the real problem.
Rather than playing Grand Theft Auto and seeing every rivet on a car or something like that, you know what I mean?
So how much time do you think a person will play, like when they sit down to play this game?
We'd like to build a game which typically we said it should be about a 40-hour experience from start to finish is what we used to build to. Now, one of the things given the nature of players today is we're going to have an easy and a hard mode. So casual game players can play it as well and not get all hung up in it. So a lot of the puzzles will be pre-solved. People will be able to go ahead and play it in a more casual way if that's what they desire. So they can sort of choose the hard, I'll say the classic gaming mode, or they can choose a more casual gaming mode.
Cool.
So you have these levels depending on what kind of game that you want, like if you wanted to...
Effectively, it would be the same levels. It would just be easier to get through a level because some things would be pre-solved for you. So a door that might be ordinarily locked would already be unlocked for you in the, I'm going to use the word casual gaming mode.
Listen, I want to invite callers. If anybody has questions for Gary, you can certainly give us a call at 831-479-1080. And we've got a little bit more
I'll be happy to answer a question or make up an answer to a question.
Remember, he does like to make up games here, so that's a consideration.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm fascinated with this whole idea of the interactive game itself and how it's evolved and, you know, where it's going and how it's going to affect media today. You know, video is going to get more interactive from what I can see and less of passive media that's evolving. And you represent a certain thread of storytelling. It's really still nascent, I think.
Yeah, how can we play one of your games, say, with Oculus Rift? I know you're thinking about it.
Well, we were interviewed by a guy who was all hot on the Oculus, and he was telling us, you know, we have to be able to play this game. And I'm like, it's going to look like playing with, like, cardboard people and kind of walking around them or something like that. And the answer is, sure, why not? I'll put them on a holodeck. Why not?
Well, you know, you could have your game as a projection on a cave or something, right? There can be.
It's just so many ways. You know, as we develop what we're developing, the state of technology continues to evolve so quickly. So, what we're doing right now, when we thought about it 6 months ago, we're doing something a little bit different now than we were 6 months ago. And in a year, when we're almost done doing this, there's going to be other delivery methods, and there's going to be other technology that rises to the surface. We used to say scumware, you know, floats to the top of the software cesspool, but who knows?
Well, what changes are you going to be doing? I mean, are you updating the game in certain ways that are significant?
We are audio. The music is going to be real digital music like you hear in the trailer because we feel that there's a lot of mood that can be portrayed by good quality music as opposed to 8-bit tinny music coming out of the Commodore speaker. Or
well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, there's some obvious things that you could make better that would have been the ideal experience in the 80s. Like really kick-ass sound.
Well,
right?
That we're going to do kick-ass sound. There are also things graphically that we can do that are going to be subtle. We can do parallaxing. Uh-huh. So that's going to be something we couldn't do before. We can do a number of sort of light effects and things like that. So it's still going to look the way it looks, but it's going to have a nuance. We want it to be the way you remember those games being as opposed to actually being exactly like those games.
Okay.
3D? No, we're not doing 3D.
All right. Okay.
But you are going for an authentic retro experience.
Yeah. If you look at the graphics, they're so retro, they make your eyes bleed, is what Ron says.
All right, folks, more with Gary Winnick when we get back here on the Dr. Future Show. Stay tuned.
Right.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Gary Winnick on this wild ride that he's on right now with...
Thimbleweed Park.
Thimbleweed Park, yeah. A new interactive storytelling in the 80s genre. Now, what's next? Is this something that you're able to do from home and work with somebody long distance?
The answer is nowadays, you can pretty much work with anybody from anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, she wants you close to the mic.
Okay.
So you can really hear you.
But yeah. I do have an office. I have an office at the Satellite in Felton.
Mm-hmm.
Great place.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was another burner friend that was involved with creating
Ron John.
Yeah, Ron John, yeah.
Terrific place. I've been working out of there because even though it's near my house, I have four kids, and I like to get up and walk to work, which is probably, you know, a quarter mile from where I live. And it feels like I'm actually at work because I go into an office and open my door and turn on my computer, and, you know, there's a copy machine there and coffee and whatever
else. Well, that's what it has, all the necessities of an office there.
And conference rooms. And so Ron comes down, and we go ahead and we brainstorm, and we Skype every day.
Nice. And he's this in San Francisco. You're in Felton.
Correct.
You're able to Skype every day in the conference room there with decent bandwidth.
And I just do it in my office.
On your office,
But when he comes down, we brainstorm in you know, conference room or whatever.
Nice.
And,
okay.
You know, as things kind of get heated up, we'll probably sort of spend more time face-to-face. But I am surprised at how easily it works, how the teleconferencing works, how the Skyping works. We were on a thing called Slack where we message each other constantly all day long, in addition to email. So between email and phones and Skype and telecommunicating and everything else, you know, video conferencing, it's pretty well like being there.
Yeah, so who needs to drive?
Who needs to drive? Yeah, I mean, pretty much.
Screens have collapsed the world, huh? You can be wherever you want and still
much,
connecting.
Pretty much.
Huh.
You know, we'll be doing a live chat with people in Germany tomorrow. So.
Wow. Nice. So do you use Google Hangouts, or are you mostly Skype and...
Skype and Slack.
Slack.
Yeah.
That sounds like an old religion I knew once. Yeah. J.R. Bob Dobbs. He's the Slack master. Is that another comic? Okay, we got a phone call.
Let's say hello to Jan in San Lorenzo Valley. How are you doing?
Hi there.
Hey, John.
Hi.
Hi, Jan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm enjoying your discussion about video games. I didn't hear the first part. Are they all basically game form, or is there... What I'm after is an interspersing of learning while they're playing this game, that they have this hunger for finding the next key or the door or the, you know?
The answer to that is, in this particular case, it is purely an entertainment product. However, Ron did found a company called Humongous Entertainment, which existed to create adventure games for kids for learning, and he did that for a number of years. And that actually was a very successful company. He created things like Putt-Putt Joins the Parade and Pajama Sam and Freddy Fish, which were all had educational value to them. But at the core of all this stuff, at least the stuff that he did, and certainly the stuff that we're doing today, it's pretty much entertainment-driven product.
I see. Yeah, it just seems to me that it would be so easy to just every once in a while put a little math problem or a little history question or a language.
The answer is sometimes that stuff fits with the story, sometimes it doesn't. Generally, in the stuff that we do, we make stuff up so it wouldn't be real. In other words, you'd be trying to find, you know, a pencil holder that is made out of, you know, Ben Franklin's skull or something like that, which is not real, but we think it's funny.
Well, I think video games are going to be the greatest invention for learning in the future, where if you want to take a class, you just hand them this video game and they go off on all these adventures and end up learning, you know, and that's level one. And then you go on to level two and you're playing something that is fun and you're learning. I remember in school, the teachers talking about the moment of readiness. That no matter what you did to somebody, you know, if 2 + 2, if they couldn't handle the concept that that was for, they just weren't ready for it. But all of a sudden, a light bulb will come on, and there's that moment of readiness. So I just wanted to throw that in
there. I mean, one of the things that's going to happen with these games, actually, is we've already reached our first goal, which is to do multiple languages. So in text, it will be available in German, French, Spanish, Italian, and one other language to be determined by the backers. That could end up being Klingon based upon what I'm hearing, but I'm not sure. And then the other thing is it will have most likely English voice track with it. And we've been told by a lot of backers, because a lot of our backers are from all over the world, particularly we have a lot in Germany, that one of the ways they learned how to speak English was by playing these games, because they could read the German text and listen to the English being spoken.
Ooh,
so language learning can be a natural.
So that actually will be in this product, most likely.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, I just remember watching my kids, my daughter is 15 years older than my son, and the two of them interacting and bouncing ideas and possibilities off each other and sometimes solving a complicated game overnight because they'd stay up all night and they'd follow it through. And it was that challenge and that enjoyment that I think that's what learning is that.
Definitely a typical story that I hear.
Yeah, fun.
All right, Jen.
Fun and educational.
Power to you.
You remember there used to be a term. Yeah. Thank you, Jen. Appreciate you calling. There used to be a term they used in the industry called the edutainment. Remember that?
Yeah, I do. I remember.
It didn't stick very well.
I remember being told I had to do it at certain times, but you know, it's hard to force people to learn. It's hard.
Yeah, it's the idea of tricking someone into learning.
Yeah,
right? It's sort of.
And we've done some of that, but at the end of the day, the pure entertainment products always seem to do better.
Hmm.
So a much bigger audience.
Mm-hmm. So you yourself are naturally think of the pure entertainment, right? That's your
that's
your
my background, yeah. Given the fact that I've been involved in, you know, comic books for Marvel and video games for Lucasfilm and Atari and things like that. Generally speaking, yeah. That was pretty much straight entertainment.
So yeah. Would you say you found a way that you never had to grow up?
Certainly if I'm getting $500,000 to do this, I don't have to grow up.
Great. And would you recommend that for...
I recommend that to anybody who can get $500,000 to make a silly game. Don't grow up.
Yeah. Do you think it's possible to combine maximum fun with maximum entertainment and maximum education?
I was with you until you threw that education.
You don't have to answer it right away. Yeah. But
I take it you didn't like being in school
no,
that
well,
much.
No, well, obviously.
You know, I was, according to the teachers that I went to school with, you didn't learn how to read from reading comic books.
No.
And actually, I learned how to read from reading comic books, and I read better than most of the kids in my class from reading comic books. Mm. But the teacher couldn't see that.
Ah, so your whole approach to expression was dissed in school. So you got
to a certain degree,
got a bad experience right away with it.
Hopefully I'm old enough now to sort of know.
That you were able to reprogram that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So we deal with people, we deal with programs, and to a certain degree, there's fallacies in either one of those cases. And we all just try to do the best we can. And some people also are more inclined to learn that way, and some people are less inclined. Some people are visual learners. Some people, they don't like to read in a book. Some people like to see it on TV. It just kind of depends on the way your brain is wired. And I think that if you make the right connections, you can have a very successful process. It's just a matter of, you know, kind of connecting the right dots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what are you most excited about in the...
Yeah, what are you looking forward to
doing? Doing this new version of the game?
Well, to be honest, I'm really excited about us creating the story right now. I mean, we've created the story to, I'm going to use the word sort of at an outline level, but to go in and sort of flesh out all the details.
And you're
of all
talking about interactive story, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know. So you have lots of branches to think about.
Sure. And we're used to doing that stuff. Ron likes to use this thing called puzzle dependency charts, TM. That was one of the jokes we had. We put TM on the end of everything because at Lucasfilm, they put TM on the end of everything. You know, Droid works TM. Droid is TM by Lucasfilm. You know, so we kind of said dead end. You know, this game has dead ends and dead ends TM. You know,
I mean, that that's mine.
Yeah,
so you create these charts to show the outcome of any potential.
Puzzle dependency charts. And we actually, you know, go ahead and use those to sort of create the backbone puzzles of the game. And then we kind of fill in all the details. And then the characters themselves are actually, in a lot of cases, characters like tools, like, you know, using somebody to unlock a door could be a character because one character knows how to fix the wiring on your phone, and one character knows how to develop photographs, and one character knows how to sing, and one character knows how to draw, and one character knows how to talk on the radio or whatever. And you need to use that character to figure out that series of events.
And are you developing personalities for these characters?
Oh, yeah.
So they will have a whole persona to them, kind of like the...
Pretty much, we're known for that in both Maniac Mansion and Monkey Island, in those franchises.
Uh-huh. Mm. So the cast of characters will be defined, and then you... Then
yeah, and one of the things, for example, I'll say, I'll talk about Monkey Island for just a moment, which is Ron watched a bunch of old pirate movies, like Douglas Fairbanks and Errol Flynn and stuff like that, and he noticed that they basically talked to each other the whole time they sword fought. So in Monkey Island, the way you sword fight is you insult each other. You don't actually fight with swords. You stand there with swords, but you insult each other. And the guy who does a better job of insulting the other guy wins.
All right, Jerry. So
there's education. You're training someone to be a good in insulting.
All things are possible. Fight like a cow.
Yeah, fight like a cow. Be a man, fight like a cow.
Yeah. Very Monty Python.
So if we wanted to keep track of your progress and... that sort of thing. You have a website you're directing people to?
Right now, the website is Kickstarter and Thimbleweed Park on Kickstarter. We will have thimbleweedpark.com will be our website. Once we actually complete the Kickstarter and we launch into development of the game, we will be posting development up there. We'll be, you know, sort of, you know, making sure that people know kind of where we are in our cycle of development, what we're doing. Mm-hmm. We're asking our community, because one of the things that Kickstarter has done is built a community for us of over 13,000 people right now who are our backers. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be talking with our community as we go.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you for being on the show, and congratulations again on this great project you get to do.
Thank you. I always enjoy talking to you guys.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah, us too. Gary Winnick, folks, and Thimbleweed.
Thimbleweed. Let's get it now funded to the tune of $500,000.
And this is KSEO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, San Jose, Monterey. Thanks for listening to the Dr. Future Show.
See you next week.